And things were going so well. And then Jesus goes and throws a big fat wrench in it. You see, this is one of those Sundays where the gospel picks up right where we left off last week. And it really only makes sense when they are heard together. So if last week was a few days too long ago, here's a quick recap. Jesus had been baptized, went into the desert with the tempter, and as soon as he leaves the desert, he heads back to Galilee. He comes to Nazareth, his hometown, on the Sabbath day, that'd be Saturday, goes into the synagogue as he usually does. And he reads from the scroll of the prophet Isaiah, where the prophet talks about being anointed to bring good news to the poor, release to the oppressed, recovery of sight to the blind, to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor, the Jubilee. Jesus then sits down to preach, and then says that today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. Last week, our associate rector, the Reverend Kristen Krantz, preached about God's vision seen in the Gospel of Luke and the vision of God we have discerned for All Souls Parish here in Berkeley. Then, this week, our gospel goes a little bit further and gets a lot bit crazier. Because, you see, Jesus doesn't stop there. He never stops there. Now, he must have said something good, because everybody began to speak well of him, about his gracious words. My guess is that it was something along the lines of, "Nice sermon." Now, there's a difference of opinion as to what happens next. Some scholars say that it's when the gathered start asking about whether this could possibly be Joseph's son that it serves as a trigger, that it angers Jesus. I don't know that the text really points in that direction, though, because you could also read a sense of communal pride here. Among others, it was John F. Kennedy who said that success has many fathers while failure is an orphan. Probably not unlike what's going on right now in Turlock, California, as Colin Kaepernick is about to play in his first Super Bowl. The local boy has made good. Until Jesus keeps going. Because then Jesus uses a proverb about physicians not being able to effect healing for themselves. And then this is where really things take a turn, because he starts using stories of the prophets of the past. Now, to our contemporary ears, it may be hard to grasp why these stories of Elijah and Elisha so enraged the crowd. This is partly because for us, these stories are not familiar. But I assure you that as soon as Jesus told the story of Elijah and the widow, and then followed up with Elisha and Naaman the Syrian, those gathered knew exactly what was going on. And they were furious. Why? Some history. You may remember that in our godly play classes, we say that prophets are people who come close to God, and that God comes close to them. Well, there was a prophet named Elijah who prophesied that there was going to be no rain for years, there would be a drought, and that famine would surely follow. You can imagine this is not the kind of prophecy that's going to make a king very happy. And it didn't. So Elijah fled to the wilderness. And while he was biding his time in a wadi, God came close to him and told him to visit a widow in a neighboring kingdom of Sidon. There he found this poor widow and her son both near death without much food, and then somehow, through God's presence, the widow's meager store of wheat and oil replenished themselves, and they survived the famine. Now, keep in mind that this very same famine was throughout Israel, and as Jesus says, there were plenty of widows in Israel. And because of their place in the culture, many of them were poor and in dire need, but God sent Elijah specifically to someone outside of the circle. Curious. So at this point, you can imagine that those gathered in Nazareth in the synagogue aren't so fond of the local kid anymore. My guess is that at this point, there is some coughing. Maybe some under-the-breath grumbling. Just who does he think he is? Now the question about Joseph's son does take on some new meaning, but Jesus doesn't stop there. He never stops there. He wants to make sure that they really get it, so he continues on with yet another story of another prophet, a story that these people also know well. So back to the story of God's people. The prophet Elijah has somehow lived a long life, even though one of his primary gifts is apparently being able to really anger the king and queen. And at the end of his life, one of the prophets who's been an apprentice, Elisha, asks for and receives a double blessing as Elijah ascends into the whirlwind with those chariots of fire. And Elisha has many of the predilections of his mentor, especially the parts around irritating people in power. This story that Jesus tells, however, really wasn't Elisha's fault. You see, there was a neighboring kingdom of Aram. That's current-day Syria. And Aram had the upper hand geopolitically. And one of Aram's generals, Naaman, contracted leprosy. Now, on a raid, Naaman had captured a young girl, an Israelite, who told him about this prophet from her homeland who could cure him of this dread disease. So Naaman took lots of gold and silver and garments, went to the king of Aram for permission, who then wrote him a letter to the king of Israel, which Naaman himself delivered. Try and imagine what it must have been like for the king of Israel to receive this general of a neighboring kingdom who was considered to be an enemy. It is somewhat hard for us to imagine this in the United States because, frankly, we dominate the world stage militarily. We are the empire. So, go with me for a bit. This might be like, say, David Petraeus headed to maybe Venezuela to get some antibiotics for an infectious disease that he has just contracted. Somehow. In any case, this was an uncomfortable moment. The king of Israel doesn't know quite what to do. He can't cure the general, but to rebuff him might have some serious consequences. Then Elisha the prophet hears of this and says to the king, "Send this general to me." And yet, one of the more fascinating elements about this story is that Elisha never actually meets with the general. He just tells him to go and bathe 7 times in the Jordan to be cured. Naaman at first cannot believe this, right? He says, "We have rivers that are far better than the Jordan back in Damascus." One of his servants has to convince him, "Look, we have come this far." So he does, and Naaman is made clean. All's well that ends well, right? But here's the kicker for the folks in Nazareth. There were a lot of lepers in Israel. And we don't have stories of them being cleansed, just this outsider. Hey, wait a minute. Is this coming into better focus now? Can you see why this group of people is starting to get really angry? Now, some have said that this took place because Jesus was attempting to show the people of Israel how they had gotten it wrong and that God was doing something new, better. It's a line of belief called supersessionism, that because of Jesus, Christianity supersedes Judaism. And I and many other Christians believe this to be misguided at best and terribly dangerous at worst. And I don't believe it's found in this text, because this anger with those on the outside getting what the insiders deserve isn't merely a challenge for those at Nazareth a few thousand years ago or those in Israel several hundred years before that. This isn't simply about one group's understanding of God. This seems to be a core element of the human experience, that those on the inside of the circle draw a tight line when the outsider approaches. One could just as easily look through this lens at the debate about immigration or about marriage to feel the same distrust and anger and fear. It seems to be that we as humans thrive when we know where we belong, whether it's with a tribe or a nation or a neighborhood or a social class or a religion or a political party. This affiliation allows for meaning and for ease of communication and for bonds of loyalty. But when it becomes rigid, beware. For once you're in, often the outside looks a whole lot more suspect, less deserving, much more different than me. Friends, I know this to be true. The biases that I haul around, well, there are a lot more than the two-bag limit on Southwest. To shift Gospels for a moment, it can be really hard to accept that anything good can come from Nazareth. Because whatever the circle is that I've drawn, or that has been drawn for me and I may not even be aware of, often it serves to circumscribe the limits of what I believe life to be. Instead of to help me understand what keeps me in, I use it to define what I must keep out. Now, if we can't identify with the people in Nazareth, it's time to take another look. Friends, as our society continues to separate along class and race and income lines, this is more true than we wish to admit. I mean, we're the ones coming to church, right? We're doing what's right. We are on the inside of the circle. And then we get this Jesus throwing a monkey wrench into the work, saying in effect, hey, all of you who have been focused only on what's happening on the inside of the circle, don't think that just because you're on the inside, that God doesn't care for those on the outside as well. God heals them. God is present with them too. Now, I usually don't take the occasion on the Sunday of our annual meeting to give a state of the parish sermon. And this really isn't one. But this gospel seems to me to be meeting all souls where we are. Because in the last 4 years or so, we have grown a good amount. Our pews are filling. Our finances are sound. And because of all this, there is a pull for all of us, I feel, to remain in the place of comfort and what feels like security. It feels safe. It feels familiar. And it is illusory. I've shared with you before what Archbishop William Temple, a great Anglican archbishop of the mid-20th century, once said, that the church is the only society that exists for the benefit of those who are not its members. The church is the only society that exists for the benefit of those who are not its members. Always. The vision which Jesus incarnated from Isaiah, the vision we have discerned from God, these are not visions for us. These are visions for all. Once we walk through those copper doors, we cannot let them close behind us. So what we're doing right now, when we worship God every Sunday, we do for those who are yet on the outside. When we prepare a Bible study or trim a hedge, we do so for those who are yet on the outside. When we give a pledge or prepare a budget, we do so for those who are yet on the outside. We do this not knowing the edge people, as one scholar has called them, who they might be. The king of Israel did not expect a general of the Aramean army. Elijah did not expect to travel to a widow from Sidon. But what we do know from these sacred stories is that these people will be found on the margins, existing on the edges. They are likely to be vulnerable, as people who live between two worlds often are. And God is already at work in them. We do not need to save them. We do need to be present with them, to stand beside them, and to trust that the Spirit will guide us in all the rest. Because God is on the loose. But to meet her, first, we must take a step outside the circle.